Item 6A, this is a private equity review from staff. Rishi, you were on the memo, so I assume this is your item.
Hello, everyone. Yes, it is. It is my item. Can I be given present a status, please? Thank you. Okay, great. So good morning, everyone. We're still in the morning. We're going to talk about our private equity program today. So starting on slide two, you'll see I'll kick us off with a review of Cicero's private equity program, and then I'll also discuss Cicero's private equity strategy. I'll then hand it off to StepStone's private equity team to cover a private equity market update, including some commentary on the impact of COVID. StepStone will also discuss investment pacing and portfolio performance. So before I get started, to the trustees, please don't hesitate to jump in with questions. As I'm walking through my slides, I'll also pause for questions during the presentation. Starting on slide four now, you saw a similar slide in the private credit presentation in September. On the left of this slide, you can see that private equity is part of Cicero's growth allocation. We have an 11% target and about a little over $1 billion program size currently. Now, those numbers may change depending on the outcome of the asset liability study that's in process, but that's where we are today. Cicero, as many of you know, has been investing in private equity since the 1990s, primarily in fund of funds, but we recently pivoted to a primary fund implementation model, and I'll discuss that pivot later in the presentation. Just brief background on my private equity experience. So I spent almost my whole career in the private equity asset class. I've worked as both a general partner and limited partner prior to joining Cicero. So I've worked at a private equity manager where we bought control positions in companies. I've also worked as an institutional investor like Cicero that invests in those private equity managers. Moving on to slide five now. Here you can see the key participants in Cicero's private equity program, starting at the top of the slide and moving down. Cicero manages the private equity program, including portfolio construction, portfolio management, strategy selection, and manager selection. Cicero partners directly with private equity investment managers. Those managers source, evaluate, execute, and monitor underlying private equity investments in companies. And StepStone is in an advisory role to Cicero. They're also responsible for pacing analysis, portfolio monitoring, and reporting. As you probably recall, Cicero has a relationship with StepStone for both private credit and private equity. However, StepStone's role in each asset class is a little different. In private credit, StepStone manages Cicero's private credit program, and Cicero is in more of an oversight role within private credit. In private equity, Cicero manages the program, and StepStone is in an advisory role. So we engage with StepStone a little differently in each asset class. Moving on to slide seven. Now, that brief overview of our private equity program, I wanted to talk a little bit about Cicero's private equity strategy. Before we jump into this section, just a few comments on private equity as an asset class overall. So I think institutional investors view private equity as a risky asset class, and I think that's justified. That said, I think the level of risk and also the level of potential return within private equity can vary widely depending on how the private equity program is implemented. So one of the key goals in this section is to explain Cicero's private equity strategy so you can get a sense for our investment process and the risk profile that we're targeting within private equity. Starting with slide seven, this is a graphical summary of how we approach private equity investing. You can see that we have an investment pacing plan that overlays our strategy, and that's represented by the gray bar at the top of this slide. Our pacing plan determines the investment pace we target each year over a 5 to 10 year period to achieve our targeted private equity exposure. One of the key elements of our private equity program is that we are not trying to time the market. We think that's a very difficult thing to do as a limited partner in the private equity asset class. And history has shown that limited partners haven't done a great job of timing the private equity market. So, you know, our goal is to stick to our pacing plan. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't take the market environment into account. We absolutely do, and that might impact the types of investments we target. It just isn't expected to impact our projected investment pace. Below the gray investment pacing bar, you see a summary of our top-down and bottom-up approach to private equity investing. You see the top-down elements in the blue arrow just below the gray bar, economic outlook, geographic and sector focuses, choice of implementation and sub-strategy. And then the bottom-up elements are in the green arrow, and those focus on bottoms-up detailed evaluation of specific investment managers to see if they're a good fit for Cicero's portfolio. Now, where our top-down and bottom-up views intersect, you can see those represent our highest priority or highest conviction investment opportunities. And I'll speak more to the specific top-down and bottom-up elements I've listed here in the coming slides. Again, this is just meant to be a summary of our overall approach to private equity. Slide eight digs a little bit deeper into the elements of our top-down strategy. You see major geographies, sectors, implementation models, and sub-strategies on this slide. The red dashed boxes represent current areas of focus for Cicero's private equity program. Starting with geography at the top of the slide, historically and currently, Cicero's primary focus has been on North America and primarily on the US. And that makes sense given that our liabilities at the plan level are in US dollars, so we're not taking on excess currency risk there. And North America has been and continues to be a strong private equity market. We have limited exposure to Europe and Asia, and that comes mostly from our legacy fund of funds investments. Moving on to sectors, you'll notice that I haven't highlighted any specific sectors that we're currently focused on. Our goal is to achieve overall sector diversification while trying to focus on all weather sectors that perform well across macroeconomic cycles. Now, that said, the sectors that we've migrated to since the beginning of 2019 are information technology, healthcare, and financial services. We were underweight healthcare and financial services when I reviewed our exposures in early 2019, and I used the S&P 500 as a proxy. And we remain underweight those sectors. So if there are good managers within those sectors, we may gravitate more to healthcare and financial services. But overall, we're trying to build a well-diversified portfolio. In terms of implementation choice, so Cicero's historical focus has been on fund of funds. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, there was a pivot to primary fund implementation that happened in 2018. And so it was a relatively recent pivot. Because of that, fund of funds still represent over 75% of the portfolio. That said, the current focus and for the foreseeable future will be on primary fund investments. And I'll speak more about the different implementation choices when we get to the next slide. Looking at sub-strategies now, there are many more sub-strategies than the specific ones I've listed here. You can think of the other bucket in this section as a catch-all category. Currently and for the foreseeable future, I expect buyouts to be the primary focus for Cicero. For our purposes, you can think of buyouts primarily as a strategy where a private equity investment manager purchases the majority or greater than 50% stake in a mature company and controls that company until exit. Buyouts have a long successful track record through multiple macroeconomic cycles. There's a large stable of high quality buyout managers. And so buyouts often make up the core of many private equity programs. So, you know, being intentional about each of these top-down elements helps to guide the direction of the private equity program. It also helps us to stay disciplined while implementing the program, ensuring that we don't stray too far away from our targeted investments and risk profile. Moving on to slide nine now, I wanted to spend a little more time on choice of implementation, which I introduced in the prior slide. Now, before I walk through the graphic on this slide, let me provide some context. I had three main reasons I wanted to zoom in on choice of implementation. First, Cicero recently pivoted from a fund of funds implementation to a primary funds implementation. So I wanted to cover those implementation models. Second, private equity market continues to evolve. Institutional investors like Cicero are adding internal co-investment capabilities, and some of the larger institutional pension funds have even added internal direct investment capabilities. So I'll walk through those implementation models. And then finally, and probably most importantly, a choice of private equity implementation model can have a material impact on potential risk and return for a private equity program. So as we go through the slide, a couple of things to keep in mind. The four implementation models listed here are not mutually exclusive, meaning you could choose to have multiple implementation models in one investment program. So you could have a private equity program that has 80% exposure to primary funds and 20% exposure to co-investments, for example. Another thing to keep in mind is that generally speaking, total fees and carried interest paid decreases as you go from the top of this list to the bottom. So the highest fees and carry are at the fund of funds level, and the lowest fees and carry are at the direct investment level. Now that isn't intuitive for fund of funds just by looking at the slide, but I'll explain why that's the case in a little later. The column on the extreme. Sorry, did someone?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Rishi. I was looking at this slide. I was had your management fee for fund of funds versus primary funds. It's my understanding that the fund of funds management fee is in addition to the primary fund management fee, right? So that's why.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You're 100% there. 100%.
No, that's why they're so expensive. Yeah.
Right. Looking at the left column on this slide labeled investment vehicle, what I'm showing here are how investments flow through each vehicle depending on the implementation model you choose. So, for example, if you choose a fund of funds implementation, the investment goes into a fund of funds manager. That fund of funds manager then invests in several primary fund managers, and those primary fund managers then invest in several companies. If you skip the fund of funds manager and invest directly with the primary fund manager, then your investment goes into the primary fund and that primary fund manager invests in several companies. And then finally, if you co-invest or make a direct investment, your exposure is at the company level. One of the takeaways here is that no matter which implementation model you choose, your ultimate exposure is at the company level. It's just a question of how many vehicles your investment passes through, how much diversification you achieve, what investment functions you perform in-house versus outsource, and how much it costs in terms of compensation, fees, and carry to get to that ultimate company-level exposure. Now, moving over to the fees and carry column, David already pointed this out. The reason that fees and carry are highest in a fund of funds model is that investors like Cicero effectively pay double fees and carried interest when they invest in fund of funds. So we pay fees and carry at the fund of funds level, and then we also effectively pay fees and carry charge at the primary fund level. Now, if your private equity program has sufficient scale, which Cicero's program now does, it is possible to invest directly in primary fund managers, create a diversified portfolio, and bypass the double layer fees and carry of fund of funds. And that's what Cicero has started doing programmatically in 2018. And primary funds are expected to be the focus for the foreseeable future. Now, smaller pension plans with fewer assets, they may need to invest in fund of funds because it may be difficult for them to build a diversified primary fund program without sufficient scale. As you recall, Cicero's AUM has more than doubled since 2008 from around $4 billion to over $9 billion today. So Cicero switching from a fund of funds model to a primary funds model makes sense at our current size. Moving on to co-investments now. So co-investments can be an entire presentation on its own, but I'll do my best to summarize. So co-investments for our purposes here, it involves an investor like Cicero partnering with a private equity investment manager and investing in an individual portfolio company. Co-investments are typically offered by private equity investment managers on a no-fee, no-carry basis, or in some cases on a lower-fee, lower-carry basis. Now, the skill set that's required for investment staff to evaluate a co-investment is different than the skill set required to evaluate a fund investment. Co-investments also typically move very quickly, and one of the requirements to have a successful co-investment program is that you need to have the resources to be able to move at the pace demanded by the general partners. To get through your investment process in any way from in a week to a month, depending on the type of co-investment being offered. So that means a lot of work on aggressive timelines for co-investment teams. And all of that said, if you're able to invest successfully in co-investments by building out the appropriate team, all else equal, your returns could benefit materially, so due to significantly lower fees and carry. To give you a sense, looking at performance of 600 private equity funds over the last 20 or so years, we try to estimate what performance would have been without fees and carry. And we saw that returns would have been 500 to 700 basis points higher. So for example, if your return from investing in a primary fund was a 10% net return, it would have been 15 to 17% net if those investments were all no carry and co-investments. Now, putting that in dollar terms, even if let's say Cicero's co-investment had a co-investment program that was 10 to 20%, that could represent tens of millions of dollars of additional value created every five or so years, assuming that 5-year hold period for co-investments. And that's based on historical data, so it's just a potential range. Now, if you're able to implement a successful co-investment program is a very important thing to fully consider before deciding whether to implement the program or not. And we probably need a separate presentation to explore those considerations and the level of detail needed. So I won't get into it too much now, but if implemented well by the appropriate investment team, co-investments have potential to generate value for a private equity program. And finally, onto direct investments. I won't spend too much time on this, but this is essentially where an institutional investor bypasses the private equity general partner, and they start their own direct private equity investment program. So they're essentially doing on their own what private equity GPs used to do for them. So they're the ones investing in companies directly without a GP being involved. Some of the larger pension plans have implemented direct strategies. Probably seen some headlines about the demand and compensation being paid to some of those team members for implementing those strategies. I think also part of the story there's the amount of fees and carry that's likely being saved by bringing that direct investment function in-house. So that's the lay of the land in terms of implementation models. On our team, we have experience across all of these implementation models, including co-investments and direct investments. I think that can help us to weigh the pros and cons. I think Cicero has taken a step in the right direction by pivoting from fund of funds to primary funds. But there are also other implementation models to think about, and at the appropriate time, co-investments may deserve further consideration for inclusion in the program. Switching gears now, moving to slide 10. So we've spoken about the top-down elements of Cicero's private equity strategy, and I zoomed in on implementation models. Now let's circle back to the bottom-up considerations of Cicero's private equity strategy, which focuses on how we evaluate specific fund managers. So careful selection of fund managers is a core priority for our program. So this is an important slide. As we go through this, please keep in mind that this table represents a very brief summary of how we evaluate fund managers. Full due diligence process is much more comprehensive. It includes qualitative and quantitative factors, and it's fully documented in an investment memo and due diligence package for each manager. Moving to the table now. The table shows some of the key elements we consider when evaluating fund manager: length of track record, stability of team, historical performance. In the column on the right labeled established PE fund manager, I've tried to show the profile of fund managers we've targeted so far. Since I joined the team, we've made 4 private equity commitments totaling $164 million. The specific criteria for an established private equity fund manager that you see in this table is based on the actual profiles of the managers we've partnered with so far. So all the managers had track records ranging from 15 to 40 years, had stable teams, robust institutional resources, and produced predominantly first and second quartile performance historically. The range of outcomes you see at the bottom of this table of 1.5 times net multiple of invested capital and 10% net IRR on the low end, and then 2.5 and 20% net on the high end, that represents the range of performance of all mature funds invested by the managers we've targeted over the last 20 years. So hopefully it gives you a sense of the profile of fund manager, not only that we target, but also that we've been able to get access to over the last 2 years. The reality is that fund managers of this caliber, they don't really need our capital. They have no problem fundraising. Their funds are often oversubscribed by two or three times. So you know, these managers have the luxury of choosing their investor partners. So to get access to these high conviction funds, you need to leverage Cicera's strengths, build relationships, and we need to compete. So how do we do that? I'd say there are four key reasons we've been able to compete and receive our desired allocation in the funds we targeted in 2019 and 2020. So first and foremost, a key reason we gain access is because of Cicera's pension holders. Our pension holders represent long-term stable source of capital, and that's viewed favorably by private equity fund managers compared to, say, an insurance company or an endowment, which could run into liquidity issues more recently, more easily, and some have this year with the pandemic. Secondly, we've been proactive when it comes to sourcing investment opportunities and building relationships with the best private equity fund managers. We try to do that well in advance of their fundraising. Third, I'd say Cicera has a robust but efficient investment decision-making process. And I think based on the feedback we've received from fund managers, they view our investment decision process very favorably. And finally, I think our understanding of the asset class, approach to due diligence, that helps us to compete. We're thorough but efficient in our due diligence. We do a lot of desktop due diligence before we engage with managers during on-sites. We develop the agenda for those meetings rather than just listening to the managers pitch to us. And we found that the managers also appreciate how we engage with them. I think it makes the process more seamless for them as well when we come in well prepared. So we've covered a lot in this private equity strategy section. Let me pause here for questions before we move on to the next section.
Hey, Rishi.
Hi, David.
This is David. Hi. You just answered a lot of my questions. How are we able to compete to get into invest with the managers in the top quartile? So thank you. How stable is the position managers in the upper quartile? Does that fluctuate quite a bit? Or do you have management teams that are pretty solid for a long period of time and you can count on those firms to do better for you on the investment side? Or is there some up and down?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one thing we focus on in due diligence is persistence of outperformance. So you know, the last commitment we made was to a fund 13 of a fund manager. And nine of the last 12 funds for that fund manager were first or second quartile funds over the last 40 years. So look, not every manager is going to have that persistence, but that's something we look for. I think when you're investing in a fund, an earlier fund like a fund two or a fund three, what you can find is you can find managers who've outperformed in fund one and fund two, but then there might be a situation where they're growing significantly. They're targeting different company sizes. They need to do different things to create value. You can also find situations where members of the investment team have made their money and they're not as motivated. So the short answer is yes, there are managers that have created institutional investment processes where they have been able to persistently outperform. There aren't that many of those managers out there, But I think one of our strengths as a plan is that our private equity program isn't too big. So I think, you know, we could theoretically put all of our private equity program to work with that top group of managers who's had persistent performance. And look, I mean, just because the managers had 9 out of 12 funds, they've done well, that doesn't mean their 13th fund is going to be a great fund. And we underwrite them trying to understand what worked historically, how is the environment going to change going forward, and do they have the ingredients in place to be able to replicate that performance? So hopefully that answered your question, David.
Yes, thank you very much, Rishi.
Okay, great. Okay, moving on to the next section now. So I mentioned the recent pivot in CSERA's private equity strategy, but we'll get into a few more details in this section. So starting with slide 12, here I'm comparing our current private equity portfolio with our current private equity strategy. And I think the key takeaway from this slide is that CSERA's current portfolio is not at all representative of CSERA's current private equity strategy. So if you look at the chart on the top left, that shows our current portfolio is predominantly in fund of funds. If you look at the chart on the top right, which is our current strategy, see that our targeted exposure is focused on primary funds. Similarly, the chart on the bottom left shows that our current portfolio has a large 25% exposure to real assets. And real assets typically aren't included in a traditional private equity allocation. It may be included in its own real assets bucket, or some institutional investors included in a catch-all opportunistic bucket. Going forward, real assets won't be a focus of our private equity program. And as most of that exposure runs off, we'll be reinvesting primarily into the buyout strategy. So it's just worth keeping in mind, as you hear more about our current private equity portfolio today, that it isn't reflective of CSERA's current private equity strategy. So, you know, when will our current portfolio be reflective of our current strategy? And the short answer is that it's going to take some time. In slide 13, I'm showing our current portfolio exposure by vintage year. So you'll see that about 85% of our portfolio is invested from 2009 to 2018, including over 50% of the portfolio that was invested between 2014 and 2018. And the bulk of those commitments were to fund of funds managers. And those fund of funds managers have 15-year plus fund lives. So while our fund of funds exposure will run off eventually, it's going to take many years. And I expect fund of funds to continue to be a meaningful part of our portfolio in the 2020s. And we'll likely still have some fund of funds exposure going into the 2030s. But another reason it'll take time to see the impact of the current private equity strategy is that our new investments will take time to ramp up. So slide 14 shows a typical J curve for a private equity fund. Each private equity fund's J curve will be a little different, but so this chart's just meant for illustrative purposes to give you a sense for how long it takes for a fund to ramp up and create value. You can see negative cash flows for the first several years of the fund's life while the manager is focused on investing in new companies and creating value at those companies. Cash flows turn positive in the outer years as managers start to sell companies and distribute proceeds to investors. So taking this timing into consideration, it'll take several years before the performance of our recent commitments becomes meaningful and before we're able to benchmark them appropriately against the performance of other managers of the same vintage. And although it'll take time to see the impact of the pivot in our private equity strategy, you know, we feel we've run robust due diligence processes for the managers we've partnered with, and we feel like we've been able to access some of the best private equity managers in the market. So let me pause here for questions before I move on to my final slide.
Doesn't seem to be any.
Okay, so to wrap up my presentation, you know, since late 2018, we've fine-tuned our private equity strategy and our due diligence process. We've committed $164 million to four primary buyout funds. Those were all new relationships for CSERA. All of those funds were high conviction managers for us and had oversubscribed funds. We were able to leverage CSERA's strengths and received our requested allocation in those funds. And then, you know, in terms of our forward plan, I think we currently have a good plan in place, and we've been executing it over the last 2 years. Going forward, there may be a few tweaks, but I think the core of the plan is in place. So I expect us to continue to implement the private equity strategy we've talked about today, continue to invest according to our pacing plan, maintain our due diligence process, and continue to be proactive in developing relationships with the best fund managers. So that brings me to the end of my presentation. Are there any final questions for me before I hand it over to the StepStone team? Okay.
Appreciate one question, actually. I thought that was a great presentation. This is kind of in the context of the strategic asset allocation mixes that we want to be considered.
Sorry, Jay, I didn't share that last bit.
Sorry, we're considering some strategic asset allocation changes that could affect the size of the private equity program. You also talked about how the program itself is shifting, and it'll take a number of years to kind of fully implement that shift. The board approves a strategic asset allocation that significantly changes the size of the private equity program, what will that do to the timeline for implementing that change? Would that be, problematic?
Great question, Jay. So at the current size of 11%, an 11% target, and Stefan will talk a little bit to pacing, but our pacings and kind of the $150 to $200 million of commitments each year to maintain that 11% allocation. Now, in the scenarios that were discussed with the board, the high end of one of the scenarios was a 16% allocation to private equity. And if that's what we shoot for, then we would need kind of a $300 to $400 million pacing per year in order to ramp up to be able to get to that 16% allocation. And it would take us probably, 4 or 5 years to get there. We'd need to either double or increase our private equity pacing by a third increase our private equity pacing by 50% from where it is today. And we'd need to do that consistently over 4 to 5 years in order to get to the higher end of the allocation of 16% over time.
Okay, Rishi?
Hi, David.
I'm sorry, Jay, were you finished with the?
Yeah, I'm done, thank you.
Okay, so with respect to the amount that we invest, it's not just a matter of just putting money into it, right? I mean, we really have to be careful about what we invest in. So we may have 300 million to allocate, but that doesn't mean that there's 300 million worth of really good funds to invest in, right? So we have to take that all into consideration. Is that correct?
100%. And, I think this year has been a good example of that. We've looked at probably five or six funds where we've done more anywhere from sort of, I'd call it medium to in-depth due diligence on, and we weren't able to get there on any of them except one. Our bar to let managers into the portfolio is pretty high. We need to always offset that against pacing and making sure that we're not jeopardizing returns in the program. I believe that there are enough managers out there to put our entire program to work with the best managers in the market. But to your point, David, it's a question of, when those managers come to market will dictate some of our pacing, and then also whether we're able to get access to them. We've been incredibly fortunate so far that we've been able to get access to all the managers we've wanted to get access to. But realistically, batting 1,000 like that, I'm not sure I'd promise that, because I don't see us being able to get access to every single fund we want access to.
Anything else for Rishi? Okay. Would you like to introduce our friends from StepStone?
Yes. So I'd like to hand it over to the StepStone private equity team now. If I could ask that the StepStone team turn on the cameras, could we please give Jose Fernandez presenter status? So joining us from StepStone, we have Jose Fernandez, who is a partner and co-COO, and Tom Keck, a partner and head of research. As I mentioned earlier, StepStone is in an advisory role to Cicero for private equity. The StepStone team will be providing a market update, including the impact of COVID. They'll also be speaking to investment pacing and portfolio performance. So, Jose and Tom, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning. I'll flip the pages here, but great to be here with you. You have our bios on the presentation there. So I'm turning to page five, and Tom Keck will give us market overview, what's been happening in private equity, and then quickly touch on the impact of COVID, and then I will finish up the presentation with the pacing analysis and performance for Cicero.
Jose, one quick observation. In my earlier review of your presentation, you've got a limitation only for the use of clients. You accept the fact that these are public meetings, and anybody has the right to listen in. I just want to confirm you accept that.
That's confirmed. I'm sorry if we didn't take that. We tried to take those references out. Sorry, looks like we missed one. But yes, we accept that.
Thank you.
Hi, I just want to double check my microphone's working. Okay, terrific. I see thumbs up. I'm Tom Keck, the head of research and portfolio management at StepStone. It's nice to see you all again virtually. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking through just what's going on across the private markets. Most of what I'll talk about deals with private equity specifically. And here on slide five, you kind of see the rationale for the switch that Rishi was just talking about as far as focusing more on the equity part of private markets. What you see here is the spread between the private equity index and a dollar-weighted global public equity index. So the blue bars are the spread between top quartile performance and a dollar-weighted global public market index. The green bars are the spread between the median private equity. And so what you see is over the last 20 years or 19 years here, top quartile has exceeded the public benchmark pretty dramatically, but even the median has been a pretty good strategy to pursue over the course of the last 20 years. There's been one or two vintage years where the median underperformed the global public market index on a dollar-weighted basis. And on average, you're beating, if you look at the table in the upper right-hand corner here, you're beating the public markets with just median returns by anywhere from 250 to 350 basis points. So that's why we see a lot more institutions focusing on private markets. But we think, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, that there are also kind of risk and diversification benefits to private markets. Go ahead.
Can I ask a quick question? Those Please. Returns, is that net of fees?
These are net of fees, that's correct. Well, okay. The private markets fees are net. The index for the public equities is not net of fees, but you can buy the index for pretty modest fees, so they're pretty close. Uh, So if we move on to slide six, this just shows the fundraising market over the past 15 years or so. As you can see, since the global financial crisis in 2009, there's been a pretty dramatic increase in overall private equity. This is just buyout fundraising. Year to date through 2020, it's going to be a smaller fundraising year this year. Obviously, COVID had a dramatic impact on the overall fundraising, but it's still going to be a pretty healthy overall fundraising year. And again, that's because we do see increased interest in private markets amongst institutions, both in North America as well as overseas. If you shift to slide seven, this just shows the deployment of buyout capital over the past several years. You can see 2018 and 2019, there was quite a significant amount of deployment of global equity. This year is going to be a little bit lower, but still pretty healthy given what has happened in the overall capital markets. So despite the fact that there was a pretty dramatic fall off in transaction volume in the second quarter, we have seen transactions start to come back in the third and fourth quarter, and that's reflected in this fundraising. On the right-hand side of the page, if you look at kind of where the increase in transaction volume has happened relative to the low in 2009, you can see that you know, the U.S. market has pretty much recovered. Europe has stayed down relative to where it was before, but Asia has really come on strong in the last 10 years. So there's been a lot more interest in private markets across Asia, primarily in China and Australia. If we move to slide eight, this is just a different way of looking at transaction volume. This is focused specifically on US sponsored transaction volume. Again, it shows 2017 and 18 were pretty healthy, fall off a bit in 2019, and 2020 is going to be a little bit below 2019, but still relatively healthy. Slide nine just shows the same data for Europe. As you can see, the transaction volume hasn't recovered to where it was pre-financial crisis, but it has recovered, you know, fairly substantially off of the low from 2009. And it's pretty much the same story there on a relative basis compared to the past couple of years.
Tom, if I could ask a question?
Sure.
On the past four or five slides, you've shown a pattern that indicates that it's almost a 10-year recovery for the investment transaction volume to reach pre-depression, if you will, pre-recession numbers. Why wouldn't you expect that to be the same case coming out of 2020? I mean, that pattern would suggest there's an argument to be made for a continuing southward dive of this and a slow recovery over the next 5 to 10 years.
I think it's a good question. I think the depth of the crisis in financial markets was more substantial in the global financial crisis than it was in this pandemic. You saw markets begin to crack in February of 2007. But it was really September of 2008 when things started to go down precipitously, and it was March of 2009 when the markets really hit their bottom. With the pandemic, we saw a pretty dramatic drop in the first and second quarter of the year, but things were pretty much back to normal by the end of the second quarter. So first quarter, public markets were down 20%, private markets were down about 7 or 8%. Second quarter, public markets came back 20% or 21%. Private markets came back about 8 to 10%. So overall, private equity was pretty much flat over the first half of 2020. And public markets were down maybe 1 or 2%. So, you know, you compare that to the length of time of the global financial crisis and, you know, markets there, the public markets went down 50 or more percent over that time period. So I think the depth of this crisis hasn't been as deep. I also think that institutions and general partners both learned a lot from the global financial crisis. There was certainly some moments in 2008 when we were kind of staring into the abyss and wondering whether everything was going to come crashing down. I think there's been more of a sense in this crisis that it's a buying opportunity, that prices were high, but that this is a more temporary blip that we need to get through. And if we can just kind of hold on to certain types of businesses through the crisis, that everything's going to be okay.
Just one bit of slight bit more pushback. If you're looking for negative news or pessimistic news, there's plenty of it out there that suggests that this is not over and that unfortunately 2020 will go right into 2021 and it could be a very ugly winter and spring. So I hope I can become as optimistic as you are, but this looks like we're in the midst of this thing, not in the recovery period yet.
Yeah, and I guess I should be clear. The story I'm telling is just what the capital markets seem to be buying into. I am probably more in your camp as far as feeling like there's still some time before we get through this. And it is an existential crisis for certain sectors of the economy. The Verisk guys talked a bit about retail. I think hospitality and travel are going to take a long time to come back and may never come back in the same ways that they did after the global financial crisis. So I do think that in certain sectors of the economy, there is going to be a longer dislocation and longer period of recovery. But we've seen other sectors of the economy, healthcare, information technology, even to some extent financials, have been more resilient and have actually grown through the crisis. It's a little bit of a tale of two cities as far as how the crisis has played out, whereas in the global financial crisis, it really played out across all sectors at the same time.
Okay, thanks.
If we move on to slide 10, this shows you the dry powder or the amount of capital, equity capital that is available to be committed across the different private equity sectors, buyout, growth equity, venture capital, and a nebulous category called other. What you see is that there's been a pretty dramatic increase in overall dry powder on an absolute dollar basis over the last 10 years. And even just in the last 5 years, that's grown at 16% overall. So this basically puts upward pressure on prices in the private markets because there's more capital to be put to work. A different way to look at this is to look at how much capital is getting deployed and how long it will take to get through this amount of capital. And, this is right now across these different sectors, this is probably a 3 to 4 year deployment cycle. So, on the one hand, it's an all-time high at almost $2 trillion. On the other hand, it could be deployed over the course of the next 3 to 4 years which is a pretty normal time frame. So it doesn't seem excessive from that standpoint in terms of kind of sustaining the amount of activity. But it does, I think, lend some support to there being upward pressure on equity prices in the private markets. If I switch to slide 11, the next couple pages just look at those purchase price multiples across North America and Europe. And so the green bars are kind of the smaller middle market, so companies with a total enterprise value of 500 million and below. The blue bars are the large global market, which is 500 million and above. You can see that these prices have been steadily going higher since the global financial crisis. If you look at the same chart for the S&P 500, you see the same kind of growth. If anything, it's a more dramatic growth. So, you know, this is obviously cause for concern. Our expected returns in the sector are certainly coming down as a result. But if you look at these prices on an interest rate adjusted basis, you know, they're high, but they're not historically high. And what I mean by that, you know, these price multiples are a function of overall interest rates as well as just the equity premium. So as interest rates have gotten to historic lows, you would expect multiples to be much higher. So again, this is cause for concern, but I think it's concern about equities generally, not about private equity specifically. Slide 12, again, this is showing the same statistics for Europe. We have a small sample size in 2020, so don't be alarmed by that 20x. That's really driven by a couple of transactions. I will say that what we've seen in 2020 is that really only the highest quality companies are trading. So part of the increase in multiples in 2020, both in North America and in Europe, is the fact that it's really only these resilient businesses that are able to grow through the pandemic that are trading hands. And so there's a bit of a selection bias in the prices. Slide 13 and 14 show multiples also, but these are leverage multiples. So private markets use, buyouts in particular, use leverage to buy these companies. And what you see is that the equity percentage of the capital structure, so the two lines at the top of the chart are the amount of equity as a percentage of the total capital structure. So back in 05, 06, 07, you can see for the larger transactions, it was below 40%. And today it's ticked up to over 50%. For the smaller companies, it's always been kind of 50 to 60%. What that means is, despite the fact that debt multiples are at the high end of historical ranges, the debt as a percentage of the total capital structure is actually lower than it has been historically. So high multiples imply more risk, but more equity as a percentage of the total capital structure means the capital structure is probably more sustainable. And then, you know, the other thing that's really driving this, and I'll just flip forward two slides, I guess. This is the interest coverage ratio. So for new transactions in the market, because interest rates are so low, the interest coverage, the ability of the businesses to support the debt that they're taking on, has been much higher since 2007 than it was during kind of the boom years of 05, 06, 07. We did see a dip in 2019, But credit markets basically, these ratios rebounded pretty dramatically in 2020. I think that's partly a function of lenders wanting to have a bit more cushion, but probably more so a function of what I was talking about before, where they're just higher quality businesses with more cash flow that are the ones that are actually getting financed. I will flip through the next couple of pages relatively quickly because I've used up a lot of time, but 16, just the next couple of pages talk about exit market activity. 16 looks at dividend recaps. They were pretty low in 2020, but we saw a lot of that volume come back in the third quarter. And the fourth quarter will probably be somewhat the same. So despite our concern about how far we still need to go to get through the pandemic, there are companies who have been able to maintain performance through the pandemic, and lenders are excited to give them more capital and allow them to pay dividends to their equity owners. Similarly, slides 17 and 18 show the IPO market. The first half of the year was pretty slow, but the third quarter came on quite strongly, including some very large IPOs. And as you can see on slide 18, the pipeline of IPOs is fairly healthy, particularly in financials. This slide 18 just shows for developed markets. China has actually got about almost half of the total IPO volume in 2020 has come on Chinese markets. So investors in Asia are also seeing some very strong liquidity. Slide 19 just shows the secondary market. This is liquidity for LPs in private equity funds. Transaction volume fell off pretty dramatically in the first half of 2020. It's starting to rebound here in the fourth quarter as there's more certainty in the market. But basically, you have a pretty wide bid-ask spread between sellers that are thinking about selling interests and buyers who are thinking about buying them. We have a few pages in here on the COVID impact on private markets. I know that you had a presentation from our colleagues in our private debt business. So I won't spend a lot of time here because the views are pretty much the same as they talked about. Basically, the more patient capital, both on the equity side and the credit side in private markets, plays to the advantage of businesses that are caught in a situation such as COVID, where there is an extended period of time where there's dislocation in the market, but for business models that are expected to recover, patient capital can come in, be an active shareholder, and drive preservation of value in those businesses. And so that's what we're seeing. The dry powder that's available to private markets funds is certainly helpful there. Slides 22 and 23 just talk about some of the techniques that managers use, both on the credit side and the equity side, to try to preserve value, target companies that are going to be able to come out of the other side of this, and make sure that they have the capital to get through to the other side. Slide 24, just Tim had talked a little bit about upside and downside capture across the broader portfolio. Private markets, part of the reason why private markets have outperformed is they have that kind of asymmetric risk capture that Tim was talking about. Typically, about half of the downside in the public markets gets captured in the private markets. And again, we saw that in the first and second quarter of this year. And then what to do, essentially, and Rishi alluded to this, we're recommending to our clients not to try to time the markets There are potentially buying opportunities in different sectors of the economy. And so marshal the resources to be able to take advantage of those, but essentially maintain a disciplined process through the cycle. So let me pause there if there are any questions. If not, then I'll turn it over to Jose.
A quick question. You indicated before, and I can understand the possibility of this, that there could be a buyer's market, if you will, as we come out of this thing. Is it also possible that because there's a bargain opportunities, quote unquote, that they might actually be bid up because there's so much money in chasing opportunities?
We saw that pretty dramatically in the syndicated loan markets. So back in February, the syndicated bank loans traded down pretty dramatically. And then as soon as the Fed stepped in and started buying corporate securities, that market recovered very fast. So there is a lot of liquidity sloshing around. Not all of it is provided by institutions like Cicera. In some cases, we've had to live with the impact of central banks coming in and intervening. So the pockets of value are going to, you know, potentially come and go very quickly. And that is one of the challenges that you face in a crisis such as this.
For Tom, before we switch over to Jose? Doesn't appear so. You can continue with your presentation.
Great, thank you. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Great, so page 30 is just a reminder of the StepStone team. These are just some of the people that work with you. Frankly, there's a whole team behind this. Particularly want to highlight our SPAR team, which is our performance analytics and reporting team. As you see sort of in the middle there, 90 plus professionals that are really looking after the existing portfolio for Cicera. And next year we'll put his picture on here, but Chris Cook, who's been with StepStone for 10 years, is who is in charge of the client team for Cicera in terms of the reporting and much of what you will see and I will talk about here today. And Natalie Walker, who made the trip with Tom Keck last year, the only reason I'm presenting and not her is because she's on maternity leave, but we're all counting the days until she comes back later in December. So I will then go to page 31, sorry, and show you our pacing analysis. Now, as has been mentioned by Tim and Rishi, we understand you are doing a portfolio allocation analysis. So this could change in the future, but your current allocation target is 11%. And what we model out here is how much capital would you have to invest, given the fact that you have a mature portfolio that is producing a lot of distributions. So there's capital that is coming back to you every year. You have to take that into consideration to determine how much should you be investing to stay in that 11% target. Of course, if you change the target to any different amount after your asset allocation study, we would do this analysis again. As Rishi previewed, we've already sort of modeled out some potential changes just to see what the impact might be. But once you make a final decision, we would rerun this analysis to come up with the right answer. But and also mention that this is an analysis that we run every year. So while we're running out, 10 years looking at, we want to, at the end of 10 years, be, you know, right around that target allocation. But every year we do change it, and you can see that, you know, in 2019, our recommendation for commitment was slightly more than it is in the first few years, although they converge in the last few years of the program. Essentially, our recommendation is to do $125 to $150 million in the next 3 years, and then it goes up to $200 million until you get to 10 years out, actually $350 million of commitment. So again, you know, understand you're going through the asset allocation study, and there could be changes to these. And of course, we will change in order to adjust to any, to the extent these changes at all. So now I move on to the performance of the existing portfolio, and want to reiterate Rishi's comment on the presentation that, of course, your legacy portfolio looks very different than what Cicera strategic priorities are now, and how you want to position your portfolio into the future. And as Rishi mentioned, between 2019, when we started implementing this new strategy, $164 million of commitments have been made, whereas you have over $1 billion of net asset value in the private equity program. So it's still a relatively small amount of commitments relative to the net asset value. And remember, commitments is not invested capital. That is capital that will be invested over the next few years. So it doesn't yet make sense to start looking at the performance of the new strategy. But as that takes shape, what we would expect is that we would show you the performance for the whole portfolio, but then also we might break out what the performance looks like just based on the commitments made under the new strategy. But again, it's too early to do that right now. So here we're looking at the whole portfolio, and you can see how it performed as of the second quarter of 2020. As you know, private equity has some lag in the performance reporting. So even though clearly we're in the fourth quarter now, third quarter has been closed, but we're still receiving performance information for the third quarter. So that's why we report as of June 30, 2020. And you can see some of the changes. I think there's some other pages that I'm going to talk about that highlight some of the information that's more important in this page. So I won't try to walk you through this. That looks more like a eye doctor chart. So here's performance versus benchmarks. This is as of June 30. And you can see the since inception results on the top half, the bar charts there. Cicera has produced a 9.1% IRR since you started investing in private equity. And it will also remind you that this does include not just private equity, but also real assets, which obviously have a different performance expectation than private equity. So this is everything that is in the current private equity portfolio for Cicera, which includes these real assets that were invested in the past. And this is how you compare to those benchmarks. And in the bottom, you see the 1, 3, 5, and 10 year, as well as since inception, returns and how that stacks up against the benchmarks. Of course, you had some discussion this morning about benchmarks and the fact that you're also considering potential changes to the S&P 500 plus 400 basis points, which is your policy benchmark. And I would only comment on that we agree that, you know, a 400 basis points premium on the S&P 500 is a very large premium. And one that most of our clients have moved to much lower premiums, if any premium at all to the public market. So that's a conversation I'm sure you continue to have, and we're happy to help the staff as that's developed.
Jose?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt. That was the historic expectation, right? the S&P plus 400, but that's changed now.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the policy benchmark you chose at the time. I think the idea of the premium to the S&P 500 traditionally is that, this is an illiquid portfolio versus the S&P 500 being a liquid portfolio, so there should be some illiquidity premium. So it's not necessarily a return expectations, but what premium should you put on the illiquidity of the portfolio? But to the point of when you establish the policy, yes, return expectations for private equity were more robust than they are today because of what Tom Keck just went through in terms of, as prices get more expensive, I do think return expectations do shrink. All right, so turning over to page 35. So this just shows you again, this is showing some of the information that was in that first performance page, how it breaks down. So how did we go from the market value on March 31, 2019, that's on the left-hand side here. And then, how you get to the June 30, 2020 market value. What happens is you contributed capital, $21 million. You received distributions of $35.1 million. And there was a net gain in the portfolio of $72 million. So that's the valuation bridge from $1 billion last year to $1.06 billion at the end of June 30, 2020. And then on the right-hand side is just that since inception, Cicera has made a total gain of $692 million in this portfolio against the $1.6 billion that have been contributed. And the very right-hand side, it shows you, how that breaks out is $1.2 billion of distributions. That's actually capital you have received. And then what is still exposed in the market, the $1.60 billion, that is the current net asset value of the portfolio. We go to page 36. This just shows you the cash flow activity. And what you can see here is the gray bars represent the distributions that are sent back from the managers you invested in to Cicera. And the blue bars represent the contributions as capital that Cicera contributes to these managers to invest. And what you can see is that the portfolio was about cash flow even in 2012 and 13. But other than that, up to 2018, you were making more contributions than you were receiving in distributions. That turned in 2018, where you received substantially more distributions than the capital you contributed. It reversed in 2019, but 2020 is shaping up to be also a cash flow positive year, meaning that you are receiving more distributions than contributions. Again, given the shift in the strategy, the historical data here, is illustrative for what's happened, but this is going to change as you make commitments in a different strategy. And Rishi had a great page there illustrating the J-curve effect of the new commitments take some time to start realizing the value that we expect from them. Going to page 37 now. This shows you the diversification of the portfolio. And I think, you can see what it is today on the left-hand side. Again, Rishi touched on these in terms of we're turning this portfolio into much more buyout-centric portfolio. You can see real assets still 25% of the portfolio here. We won't make new commitments there. So that portfolio will start shrinking from 25%, but it will take some time until it's completely out of the system. And then on the right-hand side, again, you can see that fund of funds are the lion's share of the portfolio. And again, we're moving away from that. And so that will go down as the primary part of this goes up. And then if you look at the diversification, here's two more ways to look at it. One is by investment manager on the left-hand side circle here. And you can see who the top managers are, but still the three largest exposures are to fund of fund managers. So again, that will, you know, that will start to change, but that's it just shows you that this will take time to for the new strategies to take hold. And then the left hand side is the diversification by industry. You know, IT at 32% is their largest exposure. That actually turns out to be a good thing during the pandemic. IT has outperformed as we are all meeting virtually and using all kinds of different software products. Clearly, IT has been an outperformer during this period. So having that exposure, that as your largest exposure, has been a positive. And Rishi highlighted during his presentation that relative to the S&P 500, you're somewhat under allocated to healthcare and financials, and that's one area that Cicera will be looking at opportunistically if there are very good managers there available. Page 39, I'm a recovery lawyer, so I love this page, but I'm sure the rest of you don't. any questions?
Any questions for Jose? Doesn't appear so. So is that the end of your presentation?
That is the end of our presentation, and I appreciate your time. Thank you very much for having us today.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you for presenting.
Great.
Take a look at the time. Okay, we're doing well.